What are you doing?
I'm ready.
Were you ready last month?
Look, the cricket was fun. It was a lot of fun. We won. Won the series.
By we, you don't mean...
I was playing.
The Mons.
I was playing. How do you know I wasn't playing? You wouldn't have watched it. So how do you know I wasn't actually out on the ground batting? I might have bowled a few overs.
I'm pretty sure you weren't.
Because I'm fat?
No, because you're Ian.
Ah.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott, and seated opposite me is your other host in Going to the Cricket, Mont.
That's just not fair. Look, we said we'd do a podcast this year for 2014 every month. And the only reason it was a stuff-up, it's mostly your fault and my father-in-law's
fault. It's not entirely my fault at all. There's not even a modicum of it that's my fault. I was here. I was ready.
You weren't actually here in this house.
No, but I texted you to say, here's where I'll be
and
at the train station. And you went, oh, expletive deleted, I'm at the cricket.
I wasn't actually at the cricket at that point. I was about to get into a car to go to cricket.
Yeah.
Good game. We won. That is being Australia. If anyone cares. I know Cheryl would have been upset because England have lost.
I think she was upset.
Well, England have lost all three series: the Tests, the One Dayers, and the 2020. So, let's talk about that. I think we should do a whole podcast on that.
I don't think so.
Okay. Anyway, the point is that from now on we will do every month, and that was just an anomaly. And I apologise to all our listeners.
I'm not making promises.
Well, I am. So if you're not available, I'll just mimic your voice. Hello. You just do right here to critique. This is Ian, and this is Kirsten. That's how I'll go.
I don't sound like that.
I sure do.
I don't know what that is. It sounds a bit like Scooby-Doo.
It is a bit like Scooby-Doo.
Except now it sounds a bit like Gandhi.
I miss this podcast. I like stories. Okay, yeah, go on.
So we should start.
Yes.
Straight into the books.
Nah, let's not do that. Oh. I just... Have you read
it? Oh, you wanted to do your thing, didn't you?
Well, I just like talking about the odd book that I liked.
Your new thing. I made a list. I kept a record.
Of what you read?
Yeah, because you sideswiped me last time.
Okay. Well, let's start with you.
No idea what I'd read.
So let's start with you then.
So I read things in the last month, and I wrote down what I'd read.
How many of these going to be potential... is going to be potential writer in the critic books? Because you can still mention them.
No, I don't think so.
that's good. All right.
No, I went on a Megan Abbott binge. And I read Dare Me, which is her cheerleader book.
Is that good?
Oh, it's really good. It's really, really good.
So if we hadn't have done Megan Abbott before...
I might recommend it, yep.
Even with the fact... You have this rule now that we can't do authors twice.
It's not a rule.
It is a rule.
It's a preference.
It's a rule because I wanted to do something. He said, no, we've done it already.
It's a preference, but no, we can do it. And then I also read an older one of hers, Die a Little, which is back in her sort of period. Noir, which was also good. I didn't think it was as good as some of her others that I've read, but I really liked Dame A. Dame was really good at contemporary cheerleader culture, and that was actually more interesting than the mystery in the book, but it was really good. I really enjoyed reading it. And then I did get around to reading my two Zoran Zivkovic books that I dug out of my world fantasy haul.
Is this because Charles made you, Charles Tan? He made you read them?
No, I was actually reading it when he tweeted, you should read the Zorans. And I was actually in the middle of reading 12 Conversations and The Tea Shop, which is a collection of 13 stories that interlink.
And you don't want to do that on Writer and the Critic?
No, it's a good book, that one. But, yeah, I don't know that there was a hell of a lot to talk about other than it was really good.
Okay.
And then I read The Bridge, which was also another series of interconnected short stories, and I didn't like that one as much as 12 Conversations, but it was the ending story was really, really good. There was a couple which were a bit weaker.
And now that you are officially a doctoral student,
I am.
You will have time to read nothing.
That's right. But I did read Black Helicopters, which was a chat book that comes.
Yes, I read it last night.
It's really good, isn't it?
I don't understand it. Can you please... No, seriously. I actually tweeted last night. This book went completely over my head. And Elisa's husband, Chris, said, well, they're helicopters, so that's what they're meant to do. Go over your head.
Oh, that's cute. I like that.
And, yeah. Anyway, but no, really, I understood bits of it. I understood, but I didn't understand it as a whole. I didn't know what I was reading.
Maybe we could do it on a podcast. I'm not going to give you a 2-minute pricey now. maybe we should do.
But we've done Caitlin Kiernan's works in the past.
Shut up, Ian. All right. Haven't actually read the Ape's Wife collection itself yet.
I've got it on my shelf to read.
It's got it there, but I did whip out the chapbook. And I also read Dr. Sleep by Stephen King.
Oh my God, I made
it my summer read.
Oh my God, you would have read my review.
I just read your review and I think I agree. It's funny. It was a very, it's a book I think you need to read The Shining.
Yes.
To get. I think there's
But it isn't The Shining redone.
No, it's not The Shining redone. But because well, obviously Danny Torrance, the kid from The Shining, is the protagonist of this book. So, and it references The Shining, I think, so much. You could probably read Dr. Sleep without having read The Shining and you could get the story, but I think you get so many more layers.
Yes.
Having read The Shining first. And I did like it. It was a very comforting read.
That's what I said.
It was a very Stephen King book and the rhythms and the characters. And it was a good book, but I don't think it was – it's actually a bit sad. The last two Stephen King, this one and the Kennedy one
– which I haven't read.
Didn't like that so much. And this one I thought it was a nice read. It was a comforting read. I didn't think – yes, that's funny because – we were talking about Nosferatu on the last podcast, which wasn't last month, but the month before because cricket. But
I'm never going to live that down ever.
And you know, we were saying how it wasn't that fair to compare Joe Hill to his dad, Stephen King. And actually, it's funny because I was reading Dr. Sleep, and I think because I just read Nosferatu, Dr. Sleep was a little disappointing. I think maybe Joe Hill did Stephen King a bit better in Nosferatu than Stephen King did in
King Doctor sells Dr. Sleep as the balls to the wall horror that he did in the 80s. No, it's nothing. No. Nosferatu is more like that.
Yeah,
there's barely anyone dies. The risk to our protagonists isn't actually that major. They seem to be on top of things from the get-go.
I think it's a very comfortable, comforting, rhythmic sort of read. You do know where it's going. Maybe it's even a lifetime of reading Stephen King's where you know kind of where his turns are going and when he foreshadows things.
The people he would have killed in previous books, he didn't kill in this one. Possibly. That was the surprise for me.
So I enjoyed it, but it's
he always knocks off the salt of the earth characters. You know, the ones who are in their 70s or 80s. And he didn't in this one.
No, you're right. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, I don't know. There were some things I had some problems with it, but...
There's a revelation about three quarters of the way through that made no fucking sense in my view. About his relationship to Abra.
Yeah.
Which makes zero sense at all.
There was. It was an okay book. It was a good summer read.
But that's it. Exactly.
It's nowhere near up to the standard of, say, the Dark Tower cycle or...
Have you read The Wind Through the Keyhole or whatever it's called?
No, I haven't got around to reading that yet.
So he's got two books this year.
I had a Stephen King book I forgot I hadn't read yet.
He's got two books this year. He's got Revival, which just got announced or very recently, and he's got Mr. Mercedes, which is a crime novel. Okay. So
Actually, you know what? No, I take it back. I read in between the Kennedy book and Dr. Sleep, I did read Joyland.
Which I haven't read.
Which is really fun and really good and snappy and sharp. And I really like Joyland a lot.
That's a hard case crime book, isn't it? Mr. Mercedes is a crime novel, but it's not for hard case crime. He's decided to take it a bit, go up the ante. Revival is also a horror novel.
Okay.
Dealing with spiritualism. And you've noticed how spiritual he's become?
He always has been.
No, it's become more prevalent.
He's older.
Well, his daughter is a...
She's a Methodist?
Priest, but she's a minister. Yeah. And he's obviously a religious guy. He is.
Yeah.
But the AA stuff and the greater power stuff that runs through Dr. Sleep really brought out that spiritual side of the novel, which wasn't bad. I didn't throw it against the wall because that is a spiritual component. Actually, I thought he intertwined it really well. I didn't say that in my review.
I think that's always been in his books, though.
It has.
In fact, I'd go so far as to say it's a strong theme of his books.
Okay. Let's not talk about Stephen King, though.
Okay. The other thing I just read this week, I read the second volume of the graphic novel saga.
The third volume should be out soon because the third arc is just wrapping up this week.
I'll read that a bit quicker than I did between one and two. I like number two. It felt a little more like they're putting a lot more information in there for you, a lot more backstory and stuff. So it felt a little stretched out, not padded, but just stretched out. It didn't seem to have the frenetic pace of the first one. And maybe also because the first one, there was so much new stuff in there And it was always throwing new shiny things at you. By the time you get to the second one, that new stuff isn't new anymore. So there wasn't a lot of...
Yeah, I'm not going to spoil the third volume. So I also don't think that also is... Definitely puts a pause button on some things.
Yeah, so
in a good way though.
So I definitely want to read the third volume.
Well, you could just read it monthly, like I do.
No, I like to binge.
Okay, whatever. what did I read?
So that's kind of what I got read in the last month or so. Two books for this podcast.
Well, I think that's fantastic.
I know. That was my summer.
Yeah, well, I'd like to have thought that you reread. That's right, you reread that Gone Girl, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm reading well. I just wanted to mention, because I'm going to be recommending it, not for next podcast, but probably for one a little bit after that, but I wanted to mention it again because I think people should buy it straight away and read it now so they're ready for that podcast, which is Love is the Law by Nick Mamatis, which I thought was a fantastic book. It won't be on my Hugo ballot because it's a crime novel or an SF novel. Okay. But it is one of my favourite books.
Okay.
Very good, and you'll have to read it anyway.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to recommend it on this podcast. Not you, I'm talking about our listeners.
And me.
Well, yeah, I suppose
I will have to read it too.
You'll have no choice, true. Yeah, I mean, I read some good stuff. One of the best things I read was your anthology. But I won't talk about it because I know you'll get embarrassed. you'll get faux embarrassed. You'll go, don't say nice things about me. And you read my review. My review is there for all to see. If people aren't reading it, they're foolish. End of fucking story. Should win awards. Australian ones, unfortunately. Not that that's a problem with Australian awards, but it deserves international cred. And I probably won't get that because people are more American-centric than they should be.
Oh, thank you, I think.
That was a compliment. No, I think it's great that it'll be on a Dittmar Aurealis, etc. All I'm saying is that it should also be on Hugo, World Fantasy, Stoker. And Stoker, definitely.
And we're moving on.
Why? Oh, yeah, that's right, because it's about you. I wanted to mention, The Secret Lives of Married Women by Lisa Wald, which is a hard case crime book, a recent one.
I read a review of that.
By me?
No, somewhere else. And then I read a review of yours as well.
Yeah, I love that. I didn't expect to like it. It was probably vanilla S&M fiction because it wasn't
The other review I read wasn't glowing.
No?
No.
I thought it was really cool. It's completely out of my comfort zone. I don't normally wouldn't read that sort of stuff in a million years, but I thought it was really – maybe for people who know that genre it was cliched, but for me it wasn't. It was the character stuff that worked, not the whips and chains. Not that there was much of that. I'm not helping myself here.
What else is on your list?
Yeah, the one I did want to mention was, which again could be a writer in the critic book. See, I've done – okay, so the King Industry, as it's called now, that is the Stephen King family.
Right. You've
got Owen, Joe Hill, Stephen himself.
Yep.
And Kelly Braffett.
Oh.
Kelly Braffett is married to Owen. She's also a writer. So not Tabby King, because Tabby King isn't writing at the moment. But those four all have books out. I've read Nosferatu. Okay. I've read Dr. Sleep. I have Double Feature, but I haven't read it.
Yeah.
Have you read Double Feature?
No.
Okay. I have read Kelly Braffett's book, though, Save Yourself.
Okay.
Which I think is really – it's the best of the three. I think it's fantastic.
That's a big call.
It is a big call. It's a crime novel, sort of. It's marketed as a crime novel. I wouldn't call it. It's more small town shit that goes on in a small town as a result of a tragic accident.
Okay.
So what happens to a couple of families that, not actually the victims, the direct victims of the accident, but the family of the person who caused the accident and some people in that orbit. And it is fantastic. Okay. I have one problem with it, which is sort of cliched goth problem.
Cliched goth problem. They're a goth, but it's a cliche. No, that they're a goth.
No, it's just that the goths in it are emo, angsty, and they feel carbon cut. They feel like cutouts rather than,
Okay.
But that's why I'm thinking of making it a writer in the critic book, because I think you'd have a really interesting take on it.
Okay. Right.
So that's one thing I've read recently. I haven't put it up on my site as a review because I haven't done that yet, but I just finished it.
But we might do it as a podcast book.
Yes, so I may not do a review. So, yeah, that's about it for me. So some good stuff there. So we're doing A Tale for the Time Being.
Yep.
And by Ruth Ozeki first, and then we'll do Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn.
Gillian. It's with a hard G.
Thank you. Gillian Flynn.
Yes.
So
we'll start with the Ozeki book.
Ozeki and I will do a Wikipedia description. Actually, I'm going to use the very, very short description that's at the very top, which is it's narrated by two characters, a 16-year-old girl in Tokyo whose name is Nao, or Nakoti. It's pronounced Nao, apparently. Now. and a who keeps a diary, and a writer living on an island off the British Columbia whose name is Ruth, who strangely is Ruth Ozeki.
Pretty much.
No one mentions that in the reviews. Did you notice that? I read a number of your reviews. No one – either it's so obvious it's not worth noting, but I think actually it's critical to the book.
It is.
To know that, that Ruth is writing – it's Oliver is her husband, real
yes,
husband.
Yes, real husband.
Living in the real place that they live.
Yes.
She's working on a project that she may have actually been working on really at the time. I mean – it's and yet people have treated. Oh, we'll get to that in a second.
Yes, we'll
so,
get to that.
So the, essentially, this character Ruth Ozeki, who's a real person called Ruth Ozeki.
Well, no, I mean the character in the book
called Ruth Ozeki.
Who's called Ruth? Ruth
not who's Ozeki, just called Ruth. Just Ruth.
Who's married to Oliver?
Oliver finds a diary written by now washed up on the shore, and she thinks it might be a result of the tsunami.
Well, Oliver thinks it might be
yes
a result of the tsunami.
Correct. But it might be something a bit more mysterious.
Yes.
And it's, yes, it's a diary. Well, people have said it's a bit contrived because she could have just read to the very end of the diary.
Look, any
epistolary
almost type. Any epistolary type.
The thing
book
is, I need to get, we need to get this contrived bit out of the way first, right? Because the way the book is set out is it breaks up Ruth's story and then Now's diary stuff, okay? With an epistolary book, letters are passing backwards and forwards. So
yes.
The person,
there's a reason for gaps.
Correct.
Yes.
In this, she gets the whole thing.
Yeah.
In entirety.
Yes.
So there's no reason for a gap, yet there are because...
Well, a reason is given. And that's...
It's tied into the plot of the story, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reason that the character Ruth gives of her taking her time is that she decides when she first starts to read this diary that she would like to read it... in a way that is approaching an analogy to how it was written.
Yes.
So she will read a bit, and then when there's a section break or you know, a new entry starts, she will stop and wait a day.
And that's why people say it's
because
contrived.
Because she doesn't know how much time has passed between entries.
No, but that's why people say it's contrived, because...
It is.
Why would you think that? Why would you have that thought process even to begin with?
No, I don't have any problem with that. Because part of it is she's wanting to do that. She's wanting to read it in this sort of time span so that she feels – she says in her narrative she wants to feel more connected to the girl. And if she sat down and read it all in one go, it wouldn't feel like
– well,
how the girl has written it, right, which has expanded over days and weeks and months.
And
she doesn't want to compress this into the couple of days it would take to read the book. She'd like to experience it on a longer term in the way that the girl's life. So
it's surprising
so
that it's time
lives,
related.
So yeah, exactly. So the girl sort of lives along with her.
Correct.
And it's funny because when I read that bit, what I wanted to do and if I'd had – well, ironically, I did have time because cricket.
Anywho.
But at the time, I didn't think I had time, so I did read the book in 2 or 3 days – the week before we were going to do the podcast. But if I'd had the time, I would have liked to have read this book like that. I would have also have liked to have read a bit of Now's narrative and then a bit of Ruth and drag it out over however many days, weeks it would have taken to read it section by section with 24 hours in between, because I think that was actually really cool. It was a really interesting way of reading a book like this, which is passing time and having it.
No, it's about the present moment. The whole thing is about living in the present, living in the now.
Yeah.
There's a reason why Now is called.
But interleaving these other stories of people's lives with my own life.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So I'm going – and which is what Ruth wants to do.
Which is exactly
she
what
wants
Ruth
to
does.
Go about her life.
And critics have called that contrived.
It is
– but it's the theme of the book.
It is the theme of the book.
It's sort of like saying, it's contrived, but that's actually what the book's about.
It's contrived. It's what Ruth wants to do. And I had no problem at all with how she started and had the idea. I guess my suspension of disbelief just wavered a little as it became more evident in Now's narrative that she had possibly committed suicide or was in danger.
Yeah, but it's clear that Ruth can't do anything about that.
No, but Ruth gets so absorbed into her story, she gets very anxious about it. And at that point, I'm wondering, wouldn't she really now just read Now and just find out what happened? But not when she's... when she's at the point where she's thinking she could possibly still help this girl.
Does she ever think that? Because Oliver's pretty clear that...
Yeah, Oliver keeps reminding... Well, that's the thing. Oliver keeps reminding her that this thing is old. If she killed herself, she did it then. There's nothing you can do anyway. But when Ruth is reading it in the moment, she's often forgetting that, as you do when you read a book sometimes. Yeah. You kind of, you know, you get caught up.
Yes, you're saying
the
willpower required to stop yourself at those points.
For herself to disengage, yeah, when in the moment she's thinking of now as a real girl living here in the present, in danger, possibly about to kill herself. Oh my God, what can I do as Ruth? And it's Oliver who has to remind her about the fact that it's an old journal that washed up, and whatever she could have done can't be done now. When the girl's either okay all these years later or she's long dead. But it's not Ruth who reminds herself of that. It's Oliver who's constantly reminding her of that. So the bit where Ruth then stops at the end of each section at that point, it's like, I'm not sure she wouldn't.
Is it a deal breaker for you?
It's not a deal breaker for me, because I think the book is not, for all its, and it's really clever in the way that it does bring in all of the metafictional stuff, like the characters of Ruth and Oliver being modelled apparently very closely on the author and her husband and where they live and their lives and so on. So it brings in all this real stuff, quote unquote, to sort of give the book a grounding, but it's playing with reality, it's playing with time, and it's a Russian doll type book. There are narratives within narratives within narratives, and it's very deliberately doing that. So if I find it a conceit, I find it one that's wholly permissible within the vision of the book, because this is not a fictional narrative that's setting itself out to be this book that you're not meant to realize is a book and so on. You know, the whole thing is a conceit, and it's written very deliberately to talk about the subject matter of time.
Well, of living in the present.
Living in the moment, yeah, of synchronicities and all this sort of stuff, and the relationship between disparate people and times. And so the book, in essence, is a thought experiment, and every single thought experiment is a contrivance. So didn't bother me as much as if I was reading a straight narrative.
Yeah.
Where someone, a completely fictional character, happens to find a diary. And I read a book once. It's a character who was cleaning out an old house, and she found sections of a diary. Yeah. And so you had a present narrative interleaved with a past narrative, and the diary was the past narrative. And very conveniently, this character would find the bits of the diary in the order in which they were written. Which, you know...
There's no explanation for that.
She just found another bit, and it happened to be the next bit. And that didn't work, because this was just a fiction. This was just a novel telling a story, and this was part of the story, of the mechanics of the story, and it was unbelievable that these diary things would be found for no reason in chronological order. With the Ezekiel book, that's not the case, because as I said, the whole thing is a contrivance. The whole thing is a thought experiment, and it's very much telling you from the beginning, from when it introduces the character.
Well, this is a tale for the time being,
she's talking. Yeah. First, she's talking to you as the reader, but then she's talking to Ruth, and then you realise she's actually talking to you and Ruth.
Yeah.
So it's a very contrived book, and that's
fine. Contrived in a good way. Yeah. Look, the title says it all. Because the time being obviously is a play on words.
Yeah.
It's a tale for...
They don't realise that till you start reading it.
No.
Well, okay. I didn't. I did, you know, because...
Well, because it will depend...
A tale for the time being. It's like a tale for the moment.
That's, no, but or the being who lives in time.
Well, no, I didn't get that until I read the first paragraph. And I went, oh, yeah, time
See,
being.
My Doctor Who brain immediately thought...
Right.
It was
Doctor Who brain.
Yeah, Doctor Who brain thought, oh, it's
oh,
about...
It's a time being.
A monster that
lives in time.
You know, when you think ontologically, you think always ontologically, then you think it's about an actual entity that lives in time. It's distinct from, no, talking about a tale for now.
Yeah, which is how I read
and
the
she
title.
She means both meanings. That's exactly
she does
what
mean
this is
both
about.
Meanings, yeah.
We live in time and we live in the now. And, of course, there's the whole Zen Buddhist stuff that runs through the novel. As a result, makes it...
And we live in the now, but we live... it's more than just living for the moment. The idea is one of the central themes that runs through the book.
Correct.
It's not just like... You know, the happy, clappy, live in the moment. It's the idea that we're time beings, because we pass, our entire existence is passing through time. Passing through moments of now, but all of the moments constantly feeding into now. So we have connections with.
Yeah, and it's not an accident that now's story, when it gets down to it, is to tell a history of her grandmother, great-grandmother. Was it
that
grandmother?
She never really gets around to telling.
No,
she's
never.
Talking about herself.
Yeah. But that she's 104 years old, this woman. So this is not about, you're right, this is not about happy clappy living in the moment. This is actually about talking about the past. It's about talking about Japan's past. It's talking about kamikaze bombers, Pearl Harbor. It's very much steeped in Japan's history.
Yep.
So this is not about, you know, everything that you live for the moment, carpe diem. That's not
what
this
book
is
about. No, it's
the
opposite of that. It's about, absolutely. It's about,
but how the past informs the future and the future informs the present and it all interleaves into each other. Yeah.
And is it about having, the living for the moment thing? It's more like having an awareness and an appreciation of the moment. It's not just living for, you know, as we said, the happy clappy stuff.
I like that, the happy clappy.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I've read a few reviews. And again, most of them don't note the fact that Ruth is, based on the author and her husband. But for me, that's critical.
I was delighted when I, because I got the Ruth thing. It's like, okay. And I Googled to her and read and her husband is Oliver Kelhammer and he's a land artist and it's like, oh my god, it's actually Oliver. It's really exciting.
Yeah, well, it gives the whole thing verisimilitude and you said it grounds it because she's going to be playing around with things and there's going to be a point about three quarters of the way through the novel where your willing suspension of disbelief may shatter.
Essentially
when she seems to enter the narrative herself.
Well, that's why the book is essentially a work of speculative fiction.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Well, that's right, but here's the thing. And this is where, again, the contrived comes in. If she'd read it as one whole in a day, she couldn't have done the things that she does three quarters of the way through the book. The dreams that she's having, because they have to build up those dreams, finding the scroll, which then sort of changes it. In a sense, her actions are writing what occurred. It's all this sort of timey-wimey
stuff.
Yeah, that occurs, which... And I'm really curious, the mainstream reader reading this who doesn't have the speculative background that we both have. Speculative background, what does that mean? Speculative fiction background. Well, my background itself is not speculative. I know where I came from. Yeah, who doesn't have the background that we've got, reading and thinking, this just jumped the shark. What the fuck's going on here? What? Scrolls and a ghost and who?
I don't know. No,
I don't think they would have because I think it's dealt with smartly. And then there's a quantum mechanics explanation as well, which I don't think is needed as much.
Well, the whole...
But it's there, though.
The whole book is presented as essentially the annotated, heavily annotated presentation of this journal by this writer, Ruth.
Yeah.
So it's scattered through hundreds and hundreds of 162 footnotes.
162 footnotes.
Yeah, where she's translated stuff, she's added notes to stuff, she's made a note where she can't find something... Whether something
Can
is
I
verified
ask you,
or not.
It wasn't clear to me. Was it originally written in Japanese? Because now American born. Japanese born, but lived a lot of the life in America. And then her father loses a job at Silicon Valley, so they
come back to Japan. Yep.
But is the actual document written in English or Japanese? Because I got the feeling that she was translating it, Ruth.
There are bits in there which are in Japanese and bits which are in English.
Okay.
And I think the main journal that now is writing is an American English.
Yep.
All through it, there's lots of scatterings of Japanese phrases and poetry and things like that. And that's the bits that Ruth is translating. And there's little translator's notes where she isn't sure of an exact translation. She's saying, well, it could mean this, but it could also mean this. But because now grew up and was educated in America, she's fluent in English and she's writing this book in English.
And we just want to mention one thing. The book that she finds is actually the covers of it are Proust's, La Recherche thingy.
The translation is In Search of Lost Time.
Yeah. Which also is fills in.
Yeah, it is. It's nice. Which is another layer to, because you've got this girl writing this journal, which is a book within another book because it's within the covers of Proust's novel. Like, there's so many books within books within books in Tale for the Time Being. It's really clever.
So did you actually enjoy it? I haven't asked you this.
No, I did. I did enjoy it.
So, oh, thank God.
It was really...
Thank God for that.
I found... It was funny. I started reading it and I found Nell's narrative a little bit annoying.
That's what I was going to ask you. I was getting out this criticism. Dan Hartland writes a review, which I suppose we'll link to because you're very good at finding.
Okay, I'll find it.
You're very good at finding these things. And
Google's very good at finding these things.
Yeah. And his criticism of it is mostly around Now's narrative, saying that it's, again, that example. And it's a criticism of young adult, actually, literature generally, where it's an adult writing it, Ruth Ozeki, writing in a voice that she believes is a teenager's voice, trying to explain to a teenager how to live a proper life, how to live properly. So there's a lot of obvious statements made about obvious things littered throughout it. And yet I found it, as a voice.
I see, I disagree with that.
Now's voice I found was very genuine. Very.
I think, yeah, no, there is a lot of explanatory stuff. If this was simply a journal that she was keeping for herself, I don't think it would work. Because, yeah, she wouldn't be explaining a whole bunch of stuff to herself. Or to her, well, she doesn't have friends, but if she had peers in her circle who she was sort of addressing, it wouldn't work either. But she's very explicitly from the beginning writing to an unknown person.
Yep.
Who will become her reader.
So she's trying to, she has to explain.
So she's explaining stuff. She thinks someone who is not her, not her age, maybe not her culture, because she's, you know, she doesn't know who's going to end up reading this book. And so she's explaining things to this unknown yep. reader, which is also what Ruth Ozeki, the author, is doing for us,
to be fair
the readers.
To Dan Hartland, I'll actually quote what he says. He says, "There's a reductiveness to a lot of this which characterises the worst kind of YA, the type rolled out by lofty adults to help young people understand what it means to be proper people. Now's passages start off promisingly. The first chapter in particular reads freshly and cheekily and made me genuinely excited for the novel. But it never really deepens or complicates itself. We might assume then that Ozeki simply suffers from the same malady which afflicts many such writers when slumming it by writing for a teen perspective. She simply doesn't capture the sophistication of the voice." That's the key point that he's making, that, yeah, it's the slumming it and trying to teach kids how to be good adults and not getting the voice right, essentially. I mean, because one of the things, this actually started a slight, very, very small Twitter conversation, which you don't need to find, which sort of comes to the conclusion of, yeah, when I was a kid, I read Stephen King.
Yeah.
So that wasn't sold as young adult. You know, I read, not me personally, I'm saying this was within the Twitter conversation of, I wasn't reading commodified young adult, I was reading Stephen King, which was sold to adults, and getting my thrills there. Now, young adults have a, or teenagers have a have this commodified thing which they read. They don't read adult books, and that's potentially stunting them because it's not providing them with genuine insight. It's just providing them with, here things that you, this is how you live life properly, which is a huge generalization on the whole young adult industry.
It is.
And in the middle, this is a very short Twitter conversation, and you know,
and also,
but it is the point he's making here about this book.
But Ruth's book isn't. I mean, A Tale for the Time Being isn't.
Well, no, the point he's making is that half of it is a young adult book. Half of it is Ruth's story, which is an adult story, and the second half is young adult. It's written by.
See, now this pisses me off because that argument that, it, as I have not read that article, but as you're representing it.
Well, I quoted it.
The idea that we will distinguish young adult fiction, however we define that, from adult fiction, however we define that, simply by the age of the protagonist, is something that I find.
Well, he says.
I find that incredibly.
He says, "A Tale for the Time Being reads a good deal like fiction aimed at teens for a good part of its length."
So what he's saying there is,
half of its page count is handed over to now a Japanese adolescent, bloody, bloody, blah, and then there's, you know.
Yeah. So is what he's saying is that now's narrative reads like a young adult.
Correct.
Book. Why?
Because it's.
Because she's a teenager?
Well, yes, I see.
So is he doing the reverse? Is he saying adults shouldn't read stories from a teenager's perspective, from a protagonist who's young?
Well, he can't speak for himself because he's not here.
But this is the argument, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it reads like a young adult book because half of it's written from the point of view and in the voice of a teenager. I find that ridiculous.
I think the point he's also making is that stylistically it's like a lot of young adult fiction he's read, therefore it comes off as young adult, even if
maybe.
That's... Well, I mean, for him, it's more than just a maybe. For him, that's a problem. That's the deep problem of the novel.
But I think it's really, well.
I disagree, obviously. I love the book. I recommended it. I think the voice is genuine. I mean, I don't know Japanese culture, but I think it's really interesting that we don't just get a Japanese character here. We get an American Japanese. So it's that fusion of two different cultures. She's living in Japan. She gets bullied, etc. How much of that is accurate to the actual Japanese experience of someone who's coming from the outside, treated as literally that they don't exist? You know, that sort of thing. I don't know, but I'll trust Ozeki because I trust her as a writer. I thought it was very genuine and very disturbing and harrowing. And the way her father reacts and her mother, I thought that was all just, you know, gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. He is saying, well, it's actually the worst example of young adult type writing. He's not saying it's a young adult novel. He's saying that those sections are the worst type of young adult writing.
That makes no sense to me. I think the book that Now is writing when, as I said before, when I started reading it, I found it a little irritating. And then you have all those different beginnings where she says, oh, no, no, that's not how I should start. And she starts again. And you realize that this is actually what felt to me like a very genuine way of a young person who has this project. I'm going to write this book about my grandmother.
Yeah.
It's a big, important project. And she's figuring a way. And because she's not writing it on a computer in a word processor, she's not deleting all her mistakes, right?
She's processing while she's writing.
And she's trying to work out a way to start it. And she's trying to find a voice. And so she starts with these different voices. And she finds a way into her, which becomes her story.
She's, what you're saying, she's not as deliberate as a certain character in a certain book we're about to talk about next. Mm. Very different. Well, but it's the same, you know. Both are writing diaries.
Isn't it funny how our books often mesh?
I know. One is processing
anyway,
the way she writes.
What Now is doing. And as we got into her narrative more, she's found her voice, as it was. She's figured out how she's going to be telling the story. And what's really heartbreaking about her narrative is you get about halfway through her narrative before you realize how absolutely shitty her life is.
Yeah.
And that she's actually a prostitute. And at the beginning, when she, and I didn't realize that. I thought she was in this cafe.
Yeah, exactly.
And her voice is this, in a way, hyper real, but in a way, when you've got a teenager explicitly writing this story for an intended but unknown audience, she is performing this story, and that's what she's doing. And that's why I think at times it does feel a bit hyper real, which may be the voice that critic's talking about,
Dan,
because Now is very, as I said, she's not writing a diary for herself. She's not keeping a journal of her thoughts that she doesn't intend or would hope no one sees. She's writing a very explicit narrative, and she's not starting out to write about herself, which is why I think she is at times deliberately flippant about the stuff which is happening. And that's also a defense mechanism from her really shitty life, that writing this book is kind of an escape from that life, and she gets to be flippant about it and she gets to joke about it. And it's not until you're halfway through her book that you actually realize how serious her situation is, and how dire her situation is.
Like Ruth does, because at the beginning, for Ruth, this could just be a victim of a tsunami.
Yeah, it's someone's journal and...
And we found it in the Hello Kitty box,
exactly.
And isn't that cute?
Yeah. I think it's a really inventive piece of writing, and I like the voice. I like, because the voice is a performance, and that's deliberate on the part of Now, and then, of course, going back, very deliberate on the part of Ruth Ezeki to write her like that. She's not writing this journal as though it was a teenage girl's journal, because it's not. Now is not writing it as a teenage girl's journal. She's writing it as therapy, pretty much, though she doesn't realize it herself.
Yeah, well, I think, subconsciously this is...
You know, it's a way for her
to escape
and make sense of her life while ostensibly writing about her grandmother. But actually, she never really gets to her grandmother's biography.
And also her superpower.
Yeah, and her superpower.
Yes. Adam Roberts on the Strange Horizon review says the complete opposite in some ways, because he actually liked the voice of Now, much like we did. He thought the Ruth bits were the problem. That's what stops the novel and makes it dull, and who gives a shit about this woman? He didn't say that. Okay, sorry.
No, he did. I read that review. He kind of did. He said, her everyday today matters.
She's got writer's block. There's a windswept island and...
And her internet goes out sometimes. Exactly. And the cat gets lost. Oh, my God, you did not cry when the cat gets
lost. Well, he obviously didn't, because he thought that was all dull, and he thought that dullness infected also Now's part of a bit of a point.
Yeah, and I disagree vehemently with his
review. So do I.
Review.
Because I think the Ruth stuff is what grounds it.
Yeah.
And it affects... It's so smart, because it affects Ruth as much as it's affecting us.
Yes.
Ruth becomes this reflection of us, and we're reflecting. You know, it's just this beautiful rebounding of...
It's really good. I like Ruth and Oliver's story.
If it's just a diary, if Ruth's not in the story at all, if you just cut Ruth out and it's just this story about Now, okay, it's probably a genuine young adult novel. Maybe not. I don't know. But it just adds another layer, and he just doesn't see that.
Yeah, I think...
Damn you, Roberts!
But Ruth's story is... And this is one of those books where you have these two narratives, and it doesn't always happen. In fact, I think possibly often you're reading a book with a dual or triple narrative and there's one you like more than the others and you always want it to get back to that one.
Yeah.
With Tale for the Time Being, I became as immersed in Ruth's story
yeah.
as I did in Now.
Because we're living her frustrations.
So we'd go back to Now and I'd feel a small loss. Not because I didn't want to read Now's story, but because, oh, we've left Ruth. And the same thing would happen when we left Now and went back to Ruth. Like I found their stories equally absorbing for different reasons.
Yeah, but the critical thing is you've got to make the same investment that Ruth, the character, is making with Now's diary. And therefore, yeah. the frustration she's feeling, you're going to feel. The fact that things disappear off the internet and why yeah. can't I find any evidence of this
and
person?
And you just don't know at some point whether the diary isn't just a complete fake.
Correct.
Or
and you could say, well, maybe she's just a Greek chorus or why do we need her commentary? We're going to feel that anyway reading this story. But no, it adds that layer because if it's just a diary, because the fact that it's washed up, the fact that it literally exists ex nihilo, is entirely what this is all about. That
the book itself, the book as a whole, is working on. It's using those notions of the different levels of reading fiction.
Yes, absolutely.
And Ruth, the character, is in a lot of ways she's standing in for us, the reader, but she's also a character within in her own right. So she's doing stuff that we the reader, I mean, look, I went away and Googled Ruth the way that she went away and Googled
yep.
Now. I mean, I did exactly the same thing.
Correct, so did
because
I.
Of
I did.
You get Ruth's story and that's presented to us in this quasi non-fictional way in that you've got a character who seems to mirror the author. I mean, the name's obviously the first trigger, but then if you read the author, you go, oh, that's weird. Why would the author? And then you read the bio and you go, that's a bit weird. And then you start digging a bit further. And that's exactly what she's doing to Now. It's actually the book, in a sense, provides you with almost the exact same physical experience of reading as the character is having within the book, except without the danger. I didn't at any time think Ruth was going to kill herself or anything.
No, but she might have been swept off the island, or at least her cat could have.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? Yeah. We were thinking about Ruth and how real is Ruth and Googling facts
yeah,
about
yeah,
her
yeah, yeah.
in the same way that she's trying to do yeah. with Now to establish a reality. And in the end, as Ruth finds out, it doesn't quite matter because it all works in synchronous orbit. So, and the Ruth in the novel, of course, is not Ruth Ezeki, but she might be another Ruth Ezeki in another alternate world. I mean, we may have literally found a book that has washed up in our world from somewhere.
Yeah,
and that in the same way that Now's journal has washed up in Ruth's world.
Yeah,
which is
why I found the quantum mechanic description.
Beautiful little.
Which is why I found all that quantum mechanics yeah. stuff at the end a bit on the nose. That's my main criticism because, yeah, well, probably because it's the third book from last year that I read about quantum. So there was Andrew Crummy's Mobius Stick, there was J. Robert Lennon's Familiar, and then there's this, all dealing with, you know, Schrodinger and waves collapsing. And
I think the end bits are in there. They're not.
Why are they
in
there?
Here's what's interesting. The appendices, I think, are in there, and there's like five or six of them.
There is.
And the one I found really interesting to read was the one about the Buddhist monk.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know that. See, I knew the stuff about Schrodinger and quantum. So I know that. But what if you're not someone who does know that? Like, as you're saying before, people who don't come to this book with a speculative fiction background, who aren't familiar with a lot of the concepts of quantum mechanics and Schrodinger's cat and observer theory and collapsing waves and all of that stuff. If you've never come across that before, it might be nice to have the appendices. And because they're put in there as part of the overall conceit of the book, which is a book of a journal presented by this character, Ruth, who is annotating it and providing further information, that's the way she's able to put them in there. Were they necessary for me as a reader? Not really, except the bit about the Zen Buddhist monk was really cool because yeah. I didn't know about that. So other people who don't know about the stuff I did know about might find those appendices vital.
Yep, yeah, okay.
So, as the story, are they necessary? No. Could you go away and look stuff up? Yeah, but they're right there for you if you don't want to go away and look it up.
Okay. No,
I don't think they're vital to
I'm
the story.
I'm being a snob, obviously. I'm being a snob. I just think the message of the novel is clear enough without.
I think it is, but the thing is also they are appendices. They can be removed. You don't have to read them. They are extraneous to some extent, which is where she's put them in. And again, it adds to the character Ruth. It adds to the feel that this is a text that she has found and is working through and is presenting her notes and information on.
Yep, no, fair point.
It's a bit like House of Leaves in that way.
Yeah.
Where you've got a character who's annotating something.
Yeah, so
throwing all this information.
You'd expect to see.
Of course, with House of Leaves, there's a lot more fictional information that's thrown in as explanations.
And this isn't as creepy.
This isn't as creepy. There are no tunneling footnotes.
No.
So I like the artifice of how the book is constructed. Was it completely necessary to have the footnotes and the appendices? No. Did it really bother me, except for the way the Amazon Kindle wouldn't flick back to where the footnote started?
Oh, fuck, that was annoying.
That bothered me, but is that the fault of the book? No.
That's the fault of e-books, but not
the fault of e-books. So I liked all that, and I really like the fact that the book doesn't leave you with this very clear explanation of exactly. It's given you all these pieces, and it's up to you to hold the pieces together in your head in the way you think they fit.
Yep.
And I really like that. I guess
I'm excited that you liked it because I did. Really
I walked away from it thinking.
Thinking Ian chose well.
Ian chose well. I'll give him a cookie.
Yeah, a lot of cookies.
No, thinking that in my head, the way I'm reading it is that the Ruth in the book is an alternate world version of Ruth Ezeki. And this book, which has washed up on my Kindle. Came from another world, and in that world, that Ruth Ezeki, who is slightly different to this world's Ruth Ezeki, has found that journal from yet another.
Yeah, it's your Russian doll effect.
Yeah, and I like that. I like the idea of this story sort of getting linked across these different worlds and time, which is, again, what The book's about these relationships between how an object or a relationship will link disparate people, and yep. You've got this, and you again the book itself in our world has done that. The book has linked us, the readers, to Ruth Ezeki, the writer,
because we both did exactly the same thing. We both searched her out,
and the book itself actually can't exist until you read it. It's not Schrodinger's cat, but it's a kind of existence where the book is. Scientists really actually hate when fiction writers.
Do you know that Schrodinger's cat is an attack against wave?
Yes, I know.
It doesn't make sense for a cat to be alive.
And that was the whole point of the experiment.
Yeah.
That it doesn't make sense because if you had this experiment, the cat is obviously alive or dead.
Yeah.
It can't be in a state.
And it's only when they came up with many worlds theories where all the cat.
It is.
But just want to be clear on that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'll take back your SF credentials.
No, I know that note.
Should we move on, or did you have a final word?
But in a way,
yeah.
the book, Tale for the Time Being, very much doesn't exist until you read it.
Yeah, that's any book. There.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the whole book is
this has driven you slightly insane.
It has.
Okay,
but this book is about telling stories and how they connect people who otherwise wouldn't connect, and how they bring the past into the present, and all of that. It's what Now says at the beginning. You know, she's trying to imagine her future reader, whoever that is, and she says, and if you decide not to read anymore, hey, no problem, because you're not the one I was waiting for anyway. But if you do decide to read on, then guess what? You're my kind of time being, and together we'll make magic. And it's what the whole novel is about.
And I don't think for Adam or Dan it made that same sort of magic that it did with us.
No. And, I mean, in a way the book is – it's referencing its own magical quasi-scientific stuff that happens at the end. Like a sort of magic is actually made unless it's science. But it's also just talking about
– that whole ending is very wibbly-wobbly. But,
yeah. But it's actually just talking about art and reading in particular and what it does.
Yeah, I agree.
And how art – the actual piece of art, whether it's a book or a movie or a painting or a sculpture or dance, whatever it is, it needs the observer, it needs the reader, it needs the viewer to complete it. Otherwise, it's just paper sitting on a shelf, it's bite sitting on a tablet, it's a painting sitting in a museum on a wall.
I'm not sure if you've enlightened me or depressed me.
Which is very zen.
No, which
like is... if the tree falls in the forest.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Should we do Gone Girl?
If no one's in the gallery, the painting exists.
Are you going to just keep going on like this? Should we do Gone Girl? Does that not
I really
exist?
Like the book. But yeah, we have talked for quite a while about it, actually.
How long?
Almost an hour.
Oh, that's good. Well, Gone Girl. It's
Gone
a thriller. It's the movie.
The movie's going to be different, apparently. I read
the ending's
going to
be different.
She has, because Gillian Flynn has done the screenplay, and she's rewritten the ending.
Yes, which has upset a whole lot of people.
I
don't know why.
I don't know what, I don't know what the ending...
But it does...
Well, the thing is, I don't know what the new ending will be.
It doesn't matter.
I would find it very difficult.
If UFOs came and landed at the ending, who gives a shit? It's her text. It is her text. She can do whatever the hell she wants with the ending.
People get... You know this.
Oh, death of the author.
No. It's not that. People get invested in their stories. If they have a story they love and, you know, an ending is changed,
a character is swapped out.
People get invested in the story they've read.
Here's the thing I believe. There's two things I'd like to say on that.
Yes.
Number one is, as I said before, she's written the screenplay so she can do what the hell she likes. But even if she hadn't written the screenplay, the moment it becomes a different medium or different form of art, it's open season. So if Kirsten McDermott was writing the screenplay of this and wanted to have UFOs end at the end of the story. Well, yes.
I don't think there'll be UFOs.
No, but the book still exists, Quantum States. The book is still – the book's quantum state is still existent.
No, it's not a quantum state. It's a very much actual state in the same world as the movie.
Yeah, okay. But, fair point. But I'm just saying that, you know, people get so fucking sensitive to this sort of shit. But, I used to too, but I grew up. I grew up beyond my teenage years.
People get invested.
I used to get upset when there were continuity errors in Doctor Who. I grew up.
Oh, dear.
It was last year, but still I grew up. Anywho.
Gone Girl.
Yes.
Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. And it's funny, I read this book and I didn't realise it was like the book of the year. I read it because it came across my inbox or something. And I'd read her first novel, Sharp Objects, years ago when it came out. And I really quite liked it. I guess not a brilliant book, but it's really interesting. It's well written. The characters were very complex. And I really liked it. And this, for some reason, I missed her second one, Dark Places, but I'm going to go back and find that. But yeah, I this just came across my filter and I went, oh, I remember her.
But don't you feel like you've sold out reading a pop? It's like reading Dan Brown, isn't it?
I think it's a lot cleverer than, definitely well more written. yeah, so I read it and then I find out it's this huge book, but it's a really, it has vexed me. It's not often that a book vexes me.
I can see why it's vexed you. It's vexed me as well. I think it's vexed you more than it has me, but.
And as I've read it twice because I read it middle last year and then I reread it again this past month for the podcast. And it still vexes me.
Let's get one thing out clearly. This is a magnificent thriller. As a thriller.
Mm.
Thriller qua thriller, it is magnificent. It is a genuine page turner.
It's exceptionally well written.
Yes. Yes. This is not, more in the sense that this is this is not just a potboiler where the prose is transparent and you flick through it and yeah, whatever, and forget about it. This is a higher level, much a higher level of that. Really strong writing.
It is.
Really, really good thriller.
And you know, as an aside, just I find this remarkable, I read an interview with Gillian Flynn and she doesn't plan these books. She doesn't plan at all. She just goes down, if she goes to down a rabbit hole, she'll just come back and
find another way.
She says she writes about two books for every one that gets published because she's just writes so much and backtracks and she doesn't actually plan it out at all.
Well, but she must have at least in the original conceit, she must have at least thought this is a story about.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously she's
terrible people.
But what I'm saying is she doesn't. And it's funny because I used to think people who write crime and mystery thrillers and stuff must plan meticulously, a lot do. But I've come across so many crime writers that I've read an interview with, and they don't. They start with an idea. A lot of
famous Jeffrey Archer,
and they do the whole. If they go somewhere, and if they have to rewrite and backtrack, and oh, that didn't work, or do something else, they do. It just, you know, if they're really good at what they do, the end result looks like something that is just incredibly well thought out ahead of time, because obviously it had to be because it's so convoluted and complex.
I'll get back to Jeffrey Archer in a second.
Sorry, I just find that fascinating.
No, but it's as if people think that books are literally just vomited out and put on the shelf, you know?
No, but there are things called
the backspace and editing and...
Yeah, but there's... there are different type writers.
As I said, I was going to say Jeffrey Archer famously said, "If I don't know what's happening next, the reader's not going to know."
Yeah, but there's happening next as in next chapter, and there's happening next as in I have written notes of every single chapter of the book, and now I'm just writing it out because I have pre-planned the whole thing down to the last detail, which is how some writers work. I mean, writers work in different ways, but I quite like that. That she doesn't plan.
She
just writes and rewrites a lot.
Are you going to describe the book? Or?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So it's a book, apparently for those who haven't been living under a rock like me, you probably know what it's about. But it's a book about Amy and Nick, who are a married couple who used to live in New York and then had some financial problems and have had to go back to the small town where Nick grew up. And... the book opens with Amy having gone missing. She's just vanished from the house. And there's a sign of a struggle, and so it looks like she's been abducted. She hasn't just run away. And so the book is told sort of from both their points of view.
Yes.
And the first half of the book is told from Nick's point of view in a first-person narrative, interestingly enough, in past tense. And the diary is told... also from a first-person point of view, but it's Amy's diary. So it's a past document written in the present tense. So I liked the mirroring of those tenses there.
If you go any further, can you explain to me one thing?
Yes.
Why are the chapter headings so stupid? They're spoilers. Oh, yeah. They're always little, at the very beginning, there's all these little chapter headings. You know,
aren't they just the name and 3 days gone and 10 days gone and the date and stuff?
That's the point. That's my point.
But that's just centering you in time.
No. They do more than that. They say, okay, it's the problem because I read this on the Kindle.
Yeah.
It's the Kindle that's actually the problem, not the book. The Kindle has at the front all the chapter headings. So you know she returns. Oh, sorry, big spoiler.
That's stupid.
She returns. So 10 days gone, 10 days, you know.
Well, again, as with...
Because the later chapters are called 5 days after the return. Well, she must return, you know.
Well, again, I would say that's a problem with the ebook. Because, yeah, as you can see, the printed book doesn't have a table of contents, but every ebook does.
Yes.
And that's I guess that's an artifact problem in the same way that the footnotes issue.
So if you do read the ebook, although I've just spoiled a huge chunk.
And it's funny because most ebooks open straight to that table of contents.
I know. So you're fucked.
Which is really annoying.
You're fucked.
I wish they'd open to covers.
It's not a deal breaker, but it did mean that some of the
that's interesting because
major plot turns, not that I knew what was going to happen, but I had a
inkling. She comes back.
Well, you know she came. Well, she might have come back as a corpse.
Because if you've seen all of the, well, there's a good third of the book after she comes back.
No, she might have come back as a corpse.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Not alive. Although I thought, yeah, that'd be a bit of an odd book, though.
Mm. So that's sort of the setup, and it's.
See, she gets abducted, but then comes back.
As you've said, it's. Even at a second reading, it is a literal page turner. The chapters are quite sharp and short. Alternating between Nick and Amy's voice is a really clever way of pushing you through the book because every chapter sort of doesn't – they're not all cliffhangers, but every chapter will end with a hook that makes you want to –
Yep. Yeah, it does all the tricks that a good thriller should do.
It's really, really
well written. But written beautifully.
Written beautifully. The prose work.
The two of the most unlikable people you'll ever come across.
Really unlikable.
Like twisted. Twisted fuckers. I mean, really, really in a knot.
Yeah.
And this is my one major problem, which I assume vexed you, although I don't know what vexed you, so I'm assuming, which might make an ass of me and you. It seems like Gillian Flynn's gone in deliberately wanting to write a book about two people you are going to hate. Okay.
Mm.
However, it seems to me that once you get to the real crux, when you discover that the diary entries have been mocked up, essentially.
Yeah, because Amy's
by Amy.
The big reveal is that
Amy has abducted herself.
And she's faked her diary.
To set Nick up.
To provide a piece of evidence that would make... Yeah, would set...
The moment that's revealed, that's where you start to go, oh, Amy's also an unlikable person. Because before that, the diary entries make her out to be all sugar, sugar and spice and all things nice. And that's how she sells herself as well to people around her.
A little pretentious, self-obsessed.
Yeah, but isn't Nick an arsehole for having infidelity? The problem is that it becomes lopsided when you find out actually she's a fucking sociopath. Mm. That's my problem because Nick, Nick, okay, I understand what she's doing. The sympathy is, Gillian wants you to change your sympathy. She wants you to go from hating Nick for doing such terrible things to Amy to then hating Amy for being a complete fucking psycho.
But she doesn't want you to sympathise with Nick either.
No, but
and you don't.
Can't help. No, yes, you do.
Oh, I don't.
Oh, my God, you can't help but. Because this woman has planned this out meticulously. She is an Nick is just an asshole.
Yes.
Okay, he's just a bloke who's gone and dipped his wick in places he shouldn't have. But he's done it because he's just a misogynist
asshole.
Yes. Okay, yeah. But she's a sociopath.
she
hasn't just ruined this guy's life or attempted to. She's fucked others up.
Yep.
All right, she's got a litany of bodies in a sense. Yep. Her parents, I don't blame her. I think I'd have done them too. She doesn't kill anyone, but I would have fucked them over. But other people, innocent people in a sense, she's fucked over.
Yeah.
You can't – at that point you think, wow, Nick is nothing compared to her. Nick is just a dick.
Yeah, but I still didn't like Nick.
I didn't like Nick, but he fades in comparison to this monster that is created in that second half of it all. And I thought that's unfair. To Amy, in a sense, it's a much smarter book for me.
Mm.
I suppose we're getting to the crux of my problems with the book. Is if Amy has done all this, but it's not about her as a monster. It's she just got so upset by what was occurring, she had to do something. She's getting a revenge, but it's only on Nick, not on the whole fucking world, not on everyone else. It's Nick, and it's really about Nick and Amy. But it becomes about more than that. And that was my. Do you see where I'm coming from?
Well, this is how Amy is, and has always been. So,
but he's just another victim of hers.
Oh, he's
just another asshole she's dealing with.
Actually, just before I just wanted to go back because when you were talking about what you thought Gillian Flynn wanted to do with the book, and there's this great quote that I found in an interview with her, and she says, "I wanted the whole thing to feel bankrupt. I wanted it to feel like a marriage that had been hollowed out in a city that had been hollowed out and a country that was increasingly hollowed out." And I think that idea of bankruptcy.
Yeah, that comes through. And the media involvement and all
really
this.
Really comes
through. Yeah, it does. And, you know, the vigils and all that cynicism. And it is the most cynical fucking book.
It is. It really is.
I'm surprised it's as popular as it is because it is dripping with cynicism.
Oh, no. Because it's really enjoyable to read.
That's fucking genius.
And
isn't it? Is that genius?
And we all.
For all my problems, isn't that genius that she's made us read this?
I think everyone
cynical
who,
tract.
It's like.
She's made me.
It's like with the post-apocalyptic fiction.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
Now, stay with me.
Yeah, I'm staying.
The love that current readerships have for the zombie novels and other post-apocalyptic fiction, but especially zombie novels, those readers, and I include myself among them, they're never on the wrong side of the zombies, right? You love reading about your post-apocalyptic fiction and your zombie stuff. You're always going to be in the survivors. You're never going to be the dead. You're never going to be the ones who've lost. You're always going to be the ones who are back there, tabula rasa, brave new world, rah, 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 right? I think the same way readers of this book, and again, I count myself among them, we're on the right side of the cynicism. We're the ones reading this book going, yeah, that's so true. Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, it's all fucked. Yeah.
Didn't you feel dirty? Because I felt, no, I felt...
Which
fuck,
I think...
I'm part of the fucking problem, aren't I?
But this is the thing. And when the book... See, it's really smart in that when you're reading it the first time and you're reading through Amy's diary and the stuff she's saying and Nick's present narrative and what he's saying and not saying... because Nick's an misogynist
He's a misogynist arsehole. Yes, he is.
I mean, I remember feeling a little bit smug, right? Because I'm reading his narrative and I'm reading Amy's diary and I'm reading between the lines. I'm going, Nick, you're an arsehole. You just don't say it. Oh, poor Amy, you're a bit deluded, but why can't you see that he... And then it flips it and it points out that Amy has been constructing this diary to manipulate the person who reads it, which in the book... are the police, and in real life, is me. And it's like, oh my God, I bought right into this. Yeah, I bought into it because it is Amy, and by extension, Gillian Flynn, is using all of the tropes that we love about New Yorkers.
Did you think
and
Nick
relationships
was guilty in that first half?
And
did you think
Nick, well,
even though it doesn't entirely make sense.
I didn't know whether he'd killed her. But he was guilty. Yeah. If that makes sense.
I was exactly the same.
I didn't know whether he'd killed her. I didn't know whether he'd paid someone else to kill her. I didn't know whether he hadn't killed her at all, but something he'd done had led to her being abducted. But this is the thing, and you buy into Amy's narrative because it's super smart. And then it's revealed as it was all contrived and all manipulated, but built very solidly around fact. And most of the facts of the marriage are true. And Nick himself admits that most of the facts are true. She just scattered these little lies through it. And yeah, it's really, like, it makes you really sort of angry at the book, but like incredibly impressed.
So what vexed you then? Is it the gender stuff or?
Well, this is the thing. I don't know. I think the ending doesn't, I'll be really interested to see what the movie does.
So what?
Because the ending really doesn't quite work for me. The whole faking her pregnancy. I just don't buy that she could actually go into the clinic when she's, like, they wouldn't know who she is for a start. And she could get herself in without his permission. He's still alive. I mean, there's sort of consent forms. You can't just go and, you know, I don't buy the verisimilitude of that ending. Yeah. I think there's a whole lot of stuff that you go out on a limb for and you say, okay, we've just got to buy that she's a super smart sociopath.
Yeah.
And so she's been able to plan all this stuff and most people couldn't plan it, but she's been able to plan for it. She's been able to cover bases. She's been able to do this.
Although it fucks up though.
She does apart. Yeah. Right. But
But the beginnings of it. Yeah. I see what you're saying.
But I think that's a step too far. I didn't quite buy that she could make the actual pregnancy happen.
I'm willing to forgive her because that is the most just.
I'm willing.
You are hollowed out, like she says, because you think, fuck, now there's going to be a kid and he has to stay around.
Except he doesn't. Except he doesn't have to stay around. He doesn't.
He knows, but okay, in a normal relationship when people separate
exactly,
divorce,
in a normal relationship, and this is what's interesting. I want to read this.
This is the point, though. Read it in a sec.
In a normal
relationship where people separate and divorce, you know, it may not be amicable, but you may have hatred for the partner, but you don't think that person is going to, well, I've never been divorced. Maybe you do, but that could literally destroy the life of the child.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, yeah, people do because there's custody battles and all sorts of things, but she's got him by the short and curlies in that sense.
I would just want to read these two bits. It's about Nick and Amy's perception of their relationship. So this is from Amy's point of view, and this isn't her journal. This is from the end of the book. This is when Amy is...
She's out.
being as much...
She's being as honest
real
as
Amy as she
ever is.
Can. So she says, Nick fastened me to the earth. Nick wasn't like Desi, who brought me things I wanted to make me do things he wanted. Nick just wanted me to be happy. That's all. Very pure. Maybe I mistook that for laziness. But maybe I was unfair. Well, not unfair, but confused. No one I've loved has ever not had an agenda, so how could I know? It really is true. It took this awful situation for us to realise it. Nick and I fit together. I'm a little too much, and he's a little too little. I'm a thorn bush, bristling from the over-attention of my parents, and he's a man of a million little fatherly stab wounds, and my thorns fit perfectly into them. Which is such a beautiful piece of writing. Describing a horrific relationship.
Horrific.
And that's Amy, sociopath, okay. But then what Nick says, also at the end, after everything, also at the end, Nick says, Amy was toxic, yet I couldn't imagine a world without her entirely. Who would I be with Amy just gone? There were no options that interested me anymore, but she had to be brought to heel. Amy in prison, that was a good ending for her. Tucked away in a box, she couldn't inflict herself on me, but where I could visit her from time to time, or at least imagine her. It had to be me who put her there. It was my responsibility. Just as Amy took the credit for making me my best self, I had to take the blame for bringing the madness to bloom in Amy. There were a million men who would have loved, honoured and obeyed Amy and considered themselves lucky to do so, confident, assured, real men who couldn't have forced her to pretend to be anything but her own perfect, rigid, demanding, brilliant, creative, fascinating, rapacious, megalomaniac self. Men capable of being uxorious, men capable of keeping her sane. Amy's story could have gone a million other ways, but she met me and bad things happen. So it was up to me to stop her. Not kill her, but stop her. Put her in one of her boxes. So they both have this
Yeah.
Horrible, entangled, codependent view of their relationship. Yeah. And it's awful, but that again, that's like, Nick is like, I'll put her in a box, try and come visit her.
Yeah.
Like the animal at the zoo.
Yeah, because I can't be with anyone else because she's probably the most bizarre human being I've ever been with. But yeah, but I have to stop her.
And it is this hideous relationship they're in. And
I see what you mean. You can never like Nick because, don't get more misogynistic than
Nick's
that.
Nick's misogyny is throughout the book and it's so casual and it's just really, it,
And I want to make it clear that Nick doesn't become a superhero at the end, and you think, yeah,
No, he's not. You don't. I mean, this is the thing. The book is.
Her monstrous nature overpowers even that casual misogyny.
I think it does. I think it
That's my problem with the book. That's my only problem, because I think other than that, it's a fucking work of genius.
But I like Amy the Monster. Because even when, like, she goes to those cabins where she's hiding out. Yeah. And the people who she kind of meets there, who also they end up robbing her and taking all her money. So she had this plan to live out a few months and she had her budget and everything. And then they just take her money. And the thing is, at that point, you don't like Amy and what she's doing, but you hate them for taking her money.
That's because we're human and we do. If we're not sociopaths like she is, we have human compassionate twinges. Yeah. We can't help it.
But it's also because.
It's
also because what Gillian Flynn, I mean, she cheats a little. It's not like those people who rob Amy know who Amy is. From their point of view,
she's just a rich person.
She's a runaway woman who's
got a money belt and all that.
It's worse than that. And the reason I at that point hated them worse than I hated Amy, and I really did. The last thing that Greta and Jeff say to her is they take the money and because there's two of them, so they gang up on her and they're physically stronger than her. And Greta says, sorry about this. Next place you go, be more careful, okay? You got to not look like a girl traveling by herself, hiding out. And they know, they think that she, they don't know she's Amy. They don't know she's this rich. Yeah. There's a comment made earlier in this sequence where it intimates that Greta thinks she's run away from an abusive partner. And they take her money. They don't know she's Amy, evil Amy, sociopath Amy.
She's just a victim to,
They're awful. And then, of course, when like Desi's the other person who thwarts Amy, and again, you're not at that point. You're also not like going, "Yay, Amy's been thwarted." It's like because Desi is awful. He is creepy and a stalker. And
but okay, that's the Desi thing raises one thing. What about the fake rape? Isn't that a trope?
This is the vexing part.
I mean, Desi, you know, air quotes deserved it.
Deserved it
because he's fucked.
Because I know that, and that's something that's a criticism that's
the fake rape allegations that she was abused, which she was psychologically, but not physically.
Well, also that she there was a fake rape claim with Nick a diary, and also with the young man earlier in her life.
Yes,
and there's
because I know that's for obvious reasons a very sensitive issue in today's society, because there are men who do believe that women who scream rape are lying.
It is. And there's a lot been written about the fact that Amy's a sociopath. She's a monster, as we've said. And there's a lot been written dissecting her character and pointing out that, I guess, one of the most all of the most prevalent ways in which she's a monster are all referencing the worst sort of toxic characteristics of women, so that women will cry rape.
Yeah.
And when in fact we know statistically it's an incredibly minor event, and usually when a woman reports a rape has happened.
Yes.
And you know, the trapping a man by pregnancy, as she does at the end.
Yes.
And the manipulation and all of that, and a lot of Amy's toxicity, well, the book's toxicity, actually. Well, that's not fair. It's Nick and Amy, because Nick's a misogynist, and Amy has a lot of things to say about other women as well, and there's a lot of rivalry. So that all this sort of stuff is sort of these really...
Yeah, the harpy woman, the false accusation
all
woman.
All of this, right? Yeah. I mean, it is it is a problem that these are the touchstones used to create this female character. And on the other hand, because this is what vexes. I mean, I can see that, and I agree with that in part. I and when I read the book the first time, the rape stuff really did vex me. Because it is that. It's like, oh, yes, that of course is a fake rape in the story. It just perpetuates the stereotype. Yeah. It not even the stereotype. It perpetuates a cultural myth that actually, you know, rape accusations happen a lot, that they're common, when in fact they're exceedingly uncommon. And all of that sitting there, and it doesn't sit easily. And on the other hand, I read this great review of the book by Mary Gateskill in Book Forum, and I will link to this. And she, I don't think she liked the book at all, but she's also morbidly fascinated by the book, I think, in the same way that I am. And there's one quote I just want to read. She addresses this misogyny bit, and it helps solidify something in my head as well. So this is Mary Gateskill. Some critics have called Flynn's portrayals of women misogynist, but it seems to me like she's just amplifying an attitude that's shoved in front of us all the time, on TV, online, in countless tabloids, which are constantly informing us that some woman is humiliated because her husband cheated, or because she gained weight, or because after being dumped she had the nerve to get drunk and dance in public, that is, because she did not have absolute control over herself or the behaviour of her man, and is therefore a legitimate object of derision or pity or both. The book is a representation of cruelties we see every day, along with the social behaviours that flatten everything and everyone into instant types. Mm. And, I mean, I would recommend reading her whole review, because it's a very intelligent dissection of the book. And another thing that she said at the very beginning of it is she remarks that Amy and Nick do not resemble actual people so much as grotesquely smiling masks driven by forces of extreme artifice. And it's exactly that extreme artificial quality that's frightening to the point of sickening. She didn't like the book. And it made me think about the way we have Nick and Amy here, and the way they're presented by the author, because this is a book. And you've got Nick, who's clearly written as a character with a fairly wide streak of mostly suppressed, when he's not stressed out, misogyny running through him. And a lot of that is inherited from his dad and his upbringing. Which is another book in itself, really, talking about all this stuff and how it gets inculcated into people and so on. And no one's, not that I've seen, is talking about Nick as representing men. You know, he's a character in a book, whereas Amy has all these things. Like she said, and I think Gillian Flynn is, well, Amy is setting herself up as a straw woman, and Gillian Flynn at a remove is setting her up as a straw woman for all of this. And they're both making use of all of this toxic cultural shit that surrounds women and how women behave and are meant to behave and are meant to react. And as we often note, women in books tend, as with people of colour in books or gay people in books, anyone who is outside of the mainstream, when they're represented in books, so much extra burden is placed on those characters because they're assumed to be representative of the whole.
Yeah, exactly.
In a way, you did it with Now in The Tale for the Time Being, when you made a remark about you didn't know if this is how kids are treated in Japanese schools at the time. Yeah, but why would it have to be? If she's the only character treated, if there's one character treated in a school like that, why does Now have to shoulder the burden?
Well, I didn't know if it was a stereotype.
I know, but this is what I'm saying, you know. And so you have a character of Amy. Why is she given this extra burden as a character of having of representing women or not?
So you're saying
she's this evil, monstrous sociopath.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I have to say, I read this book, which is, oh my God, it's an incredible book. It's written by a woman who is a sociopath. The things that she says, it reads so like Amy. But this is the thing, Amy isn't representing women.
Is your line that we give Nick, not that we give Nick a free pass, but there's sort of, Nick is just an exaggeration, a grotesquery, whatever. He's a misogynist.
Mm.
No exploration of that.
And we don't say this is how all men are.
Yeah, and then make that, yeah, exactly. Well, it's turned around with Amy, it's saying, we don't like Gillian Flynn's portrayal because she's made Amy into this harpy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And women aren't like that. And people are going to think women are like that by reading this portrayal.
Yeah.
We don't do the turnaround.
But why should people think women are like that because of this portrayal? We don't do that with male characters. People don't do that with male characters in books. They read a male character in a book.
That's just Nick. Nick's
and they
a
go, that's
not,
Nick.
Not
we don't
men.
Go, oh, yes, this is how men are. Yeah. I mean, some people might, but greatly we don't. If we read a white character in a book, in real life doing something, it's not because they're white. It's because they're them. And yet we do this for characters who aren't the mainstream, who aren't the dominant hierarchical structure. And we say they must be how those people are, whether those people are women or people of colour or people with a disability or whatever it is. That must be how they are. We never do it.
It's a wider point, yeah. It's a wider point about these others can't ever be flawed.
And I'm not saying
they can't ever be flawed, because if we ever make them flawed, we're treading on an area of racism, ableism, whatever you want to call it.
And I'm not saying that this is Flynn's intent with this book, but I think it's a really interesting conversation to have around it. What I do think is her intent is that she's collecting all of these horrible stuff about our culture, the assumptions we jump to immediately, the conclusions we draw about each other on very scant information and usually no interpersonal contact whatsoever. We do it through our media, we do it on Twitter, we do it on the internet, we do it in our personal lives, and we're getting our assumptions from a lot of the cultural baggage, most of which is constructed and artificial and contrived anyway. And this book is kind of throwing all this back at us using those assumptions to fuel the book.
The reason why Nick gets a free pass is because white men generally are everywhere and there's such a diversity of white men that we can just say, well, that's just Nick. Women are so poorly represented in fiction and media generally that when one comes along that is so overtly grotesque, we think, oh my God, what's Gillian Flynn done? It's just another bad representation of women, big W.
And I agree with a lot of the readings of this book as well, which is why it vexes me.
But I understand what you're saying. There's so much pressure then.
Look, we need to talk about Kevin. The woman
The Claire Massoud book, the Woman Upstairs.
The Woman Upstairs. Yeah. Again, you get a character who's just a little bit left of what our conventional ideas of feminine are.
Yeah.
And people go apeshit about it. And this book, I think, is taking...
Yeah, but The Woman Upstairs is read as a feminist text.
Yeah, I know.
This isn't. This is completely the opposite.
Oh, I know. But what I'm saying is what this book is doing is taking all of that stuff, we have right now, and just throwing it back at us.
Deliberately?
I think deliberately. Okay. I think absolutely deliberately. Like, through this book, there's this ongoing commentary about appearances and artifice and persona and what you need to do to fit in or to be the right person, and what little you need to do to be the wrong person, and how little leeway we're willing to give any other human being.
Yeah, no, fair point.
Before we decide that they're evil and horrible. And I'm not saying that Amy isn't, but she's a construct. She's a construct of herself, she's a construct of the author, and she's a construct of the world, which is our world, in which she's living in. And she's playing with all those tropes and all that toxic stuff. And she's made herself an incredibly believable, sympathetic, wronged wife. And Gillian Flynn has made for us an incredibly realistic, an understandable sociopath, because the tools that Amy uses are the tools that society has created for her to use.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so you're saying when Amy goes and does the fake rape accusations, it's because she knows she can get away with it, because society will always allow that. Because society deep down possibly thinks, yeah, women do lie about that sort of thing.
No, but in the book she does get away with it.
I know.
But
I'm saying Amy is thinking that. She says, I know I can point a finger at this guy and say, because I know
society... Because women get away with it all the time.
Correct.
So I can do it too. But it's interesting that the lengths that Amy has to go to in the world of the book. The first account of the young man, he got taken to the police station, but she didn't charge him. If that had gone to court, whether that would have gone anywhere. But she did, she made marks and bruises and rope burns and stuff on her to get the police to actually to pay attention. And when she's talking about Nick, she's violently disappeared. There's blood. I mean, that's why her allegations in her diary are taken serious, because there's evidence of violence. And with Desi, she has mutilated herself to make it look like he had repeatedly raped her.
Yeah.
So even if you take those instances in the book, if you think that reported rape is common. How really common is it for women to do that to themselves, to report a rape?
Yeah, I look, and
you know, yeah. Like even in the book, it's she has to go to such
yeah,
length
yeah, yeah, yeah,
to,
yeah.
to prove
to,
a rape.
To prove that, to prove
beyond
a rape.
Any
yeah,
length
that
it...
I agree, yeah.
The idea of the false rape accusation myth, which flies around is the woman who has sex, regrets it for some reason, and then cries rape.
Yeah.
Right?
It's not enough for her just
it's
to say...
It's not the women who walk in covered in blood and bruises and say
no,
he rapes
it's not
me.
Enough, it's not enough but for
if,
her
if
as
anything,
a
that's the rape we want to believe.
No, I agree.
Right?
It's not enough for her as a character just to cry a wolf and say he raped
yeah.
me. She's got to actually show physical signs of it.
Yeah, and in a way...
And harrowing.
And in our world, in our social structure, yeah. they're the only rapes we really want to believe.
Yeah.
If a woman walks in bleeding and bruised, yeah. okay, maybe she was raped.
Yeah, and I get the idea that the danger is that this sort of book will make people even doubt those sorts of rapes. Because, shit, conniving women can go and shove bottles up there.
But that's a problem, isn't it? Because why – this is a fiction. This is a character. Why is this – do people worry about going into fancy restaurants and ordering a bottle of Chianti in case Hannibal Lecter comes and sits down next to them? I mean, we don't put this burden onto male monsters. We don't do that.
I understand. I agree.
So it's really this it's vexing.
We could speak for another hour on this.
It's vexing.
We could speak for another hour on this.
And again, I still don't. I don't know what side I come down on this book. It's incredibly smart. It's incredibly well put together. It was not enjoyable, but there was a satisfaction.
You'll
in
You'll need
reading
a shower after you read.
You will need a shower.
I think. Look. Final word. I think Gillian says about this is about bankrupt. A bankrupt marriage, bankrupt people, bankrupt society.
Yeah,
it's absolutely true.
And I think what you said at the beginning, you do feel a bit. You feel complicit. You feel because you're kind of cheering Amy on at the beginning, and it's like you've bought into the cynicism.
Correct.
You've bought into all of
Correct.
That. So I think maybe we should all just be a bit nicer to each other.
That's the message of every podcast we do. Just be nicer to each other.
Be nicer to each other.
So,
don't jump to conclusions based on insufficient data.
Do we have any feedback that we need to...
Oh, we did, actually. Chris emailed us back in early January, just before the podcast was meant to happen, when it didn't because of cricket.
Stop saying that.
Just to say that he really enjoyed Nosferatu and Sister Mine, and he was looking forward to reading the next two books. And he also made a suggestion, which I haven't had time to do yet, Chris. I'm really sorry. I'm going to try and get it done this month. I'm going to put a page on the website, as per Chris's suggestion, which will just list and link all of the books we have discussed.
Excellent idea.
Yeah. So thanks, Chris, for that suggestion. And he also pointed out, and I had not read it. Did you read with Nosferatu the note on the typescript at the end?
No, what does it say?
So, I should have actually brought Nosferatu with me and read it out. It's a continuation of the story. It's not a note on the typescript. It's actually a little paragraph which continues the story of Nosferatu. It's awesome. So everyone should go and read that. I'll read out Chris's bit. He says, I agreed with you about Nosferatu feeling complete until I read the note on the typescript. Did you read that bit? By the end of it, I found myself haunted by an ongoing narrative in which four child vampires are loose in the world, apparently indestructible. At least high explosives don't seem to touch them, unless someone can get their Christmas ornament and destroy it with some sinister-sounding allies out there. With the quitters, particularly King of the Quitters, Wayne McQueen. While on the side of the good, we have young Wayne himself, who appears to have inherited his mother's gift, except his tool for accessing the beyond is a hammer, and we already know he could use it to batter his way into Christmasland, and who knows what else. And he says he does hope Joe Hill is writing the sequel. And it's funny because I did not read. I usually do. I usually read notes and typescripts and stuff, but I must have not even noticed it was there.
Why the Kindle version? So I probably
It's just this little paragraph which does say how, some of the vampires escaped and they're hunting down the quitters, which include Wayne, of course, because he left. And
I don't know
if I want to read a sequel. I'm quite happy for that just to drift off, but I probably would if you wrote one. So, yes, everyone should go and read the note on the typescript.
Thank you for the feedback, and we like feedback.
So thank you for that, Chris. Thank you for pointing that out, because I probably would not have gone back and read that. And I'll also try and get that index page up on the website this month.
And ask for more feedback.
If anyone else has more feedback, you can comment at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com. Or you can email us, writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, which is Writer and Critic. And don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. Ian will kill me if I don't say that. So, That's it. Yeah. So next month, just quickly before we go, because we should tell them what the books are going to be.
Yes, that'd be good.
I am recommending a collection of short stories by Teresa Milbrot called Bearded Women.
Which is our second cheesine book.
It is, second cheesine book. And what are you recommending, Ian?
Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie.
Which is a novel.
Yes.
There we go.
It's been described as the book that steamrolled through 2013.
I'm really looking forward to reading it. It's on my shelf at home.
Okay.
So that's it. We will see you next month. Promise it will be next month. If Ian goes to the cricket again, I'll do something
it's more
very bad to him.
And it won't happen. So don't worry. It'll be next month.
Bye.
Bye. Hello, hello, hello.
Do, 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 do. Okay.